50% of U.S. workers say they or someone in their household has either lost hours or lost a job because of the coronavirus pandemic. That is up from 18% a month ago. So 18% last month, 50% this month. This is according to a new NPR PBS NewsHour Marist poll. The percentage is higher for people of color, those without a college degree, those under 45, and those making less than $50,000 a year. Unemployment has now reached the worst level since the Great Depression. Last week, according to the Labor Department, the states of California, Florida, Texas, Georgia, and New York reported the biggest increases in new unemployment claims, and a lot of people are still having problems receiving financial relief. Economists estimate that COVID-19 could cost the global economy more than $10 trillion, and it could take years to recover. Today's guest, economist Joseph Stiglitz, says that in times of crisis, we turn to the government. But in the case of the United States, the public social safety net is not working, and we are most likely heading for a second Great Depression. So as we always ask, what systemic changes are needed? Joseph Stiglitz is a Nobel Prize-winning economist and professor at Columbia University. His work focuses on income distribution, corporate governance, public policy, and globalization. He is the author of a number of books, including his latest, People, Power, and Profits, Progressive Capitalism for an Age of Discontent. And Professor Stiglitz joins us from New York. Hi, Professor Stiglitz. Welcome back to the show.
Nice to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. I just want to ask you, since you are in the epicenter of COVID, how are you and your loved ones doing?
Well, we're doing quite well, but it is very disconcerting because every 15, 20 minutes you hear a siren and you know what that means. So we're very conscious of what is going on. Most people are wearing masks. Enormous amount of civic pride, cooperation, people being really nice to each other, but it's very clear that we're in the midst of a crisis.
Right. Well, and Professor Stiglitz, you know, just looking at the calendar, talking about a crisis, today is April 29th. May 1st is on Friday, which means that rent is due, credit card bills are due, electricity bills are due. You know, so many bills are due. And yet a lot of people, we're hearing from a lot of listeners who are still having problems getting any kind of financial relief. Can you talk about this?
Well, you're absolutely right. Those headline numbers you heard from the government, the first package, $2.2 trillion, another $500 billion, the administration has been absolutely incompetent in being able to get the money out to where it is most needed. And much worse than other countries that spent a fraction of what we did in maintaining the overall economy. The U.S. has had the largest increase in unemployment, even though we were not afflicted by the coronavirus as early as some of the other countries were. That is testimony to how poorly designed the measures were. Just to give you one more example, that $1,200 check that was supposed to go out to everybody, and the president boasted he could get it out in 2 weeks. That was about more than 5 weeks ago. For those who didn't file income tax returns, which mean the poorest people whose income were below the threshold required to pay income tax, they may not be getting money until September. And how they're going to survive is beyond me.
And it was so interesting to read in your latest piece in the New York Review of Books, countries like Argentina have been able to get money to their citizens in just 3 days. So there's just so many stark discrepancies between what's happening in the U.S. and other countries.
Well, the reason for that is that there's been a four-decade-long attempt to dismantle the capacities of the state. And, you know, it's been actually remarkably successful. We had a White House Office of Pandemics that was disbanded. I was just talking to somebody about, you know, why was Iceland have such a strong response? They learned from the CDC, our Centers for Disease Control, but then under Trump, we defunded the Centers for Disease Control, so they didn't have the capacity. So what, while other countries learned from our CDC, we went about weakening the CDC, and that meant we were much less able to respond. So in every way, we have weakened the capacities of our government to which, to, you know, where we have to turn in a time of crisis like this.
Professor Stiglitz, this is really important. Can you talk more about this? You have written about this. We've had you on the show many times to talk about it. Dana Milbank had a great column in the Washington Post called "When You Drown the Government in the Bathtub, People Die." You know, so many people go back to Ronald Reagan to point to when this started. And then you have the Trump administration saying they want to deconstruct the administrative state. So can you talk about more about how we got here?
Well, it was a matter of both ideology and interest. There was this ideology that Reagan articulated as government's the problem, not the solution. But it was an ideology that was supported by interest, the interest of the very rich who wanted the tax rates to be lowered, the interests of the big corporations who wanted to go on polluting, wanted to go on making products that killed people, that led to epidemics of childhood diabetes, the problem, the opioid crisis. All that is part of the deregulation that has marked the United States over the last 40 years. So there were a lot of interests that were in support of an ideology that entailed stripping down the state. And, you know, you will constantly have to reevaluate what it is that the government should do, and current thinking about this is markedly different than it was 50 or 100 years ago. But there are a couple constants. We need government for basic investments in basic research and infrastructure and education, and even more so in a knowledge economy. So these are areas where we need more government, not less. Mm-hmm. We're always going to need a role for government in regulating. You go back to, you know, we live in New York. If you didn't have a simple regulation like stoplights, the whole city would be in gridlock. It's a very simple regulation. A major problem we're facing now is climate change. And if we don't stop pollution, it's an existential crisis for the world. Public health is another example where you have to prevent, take actions to spread diseases and to be able to respond to it. That's why we created the Centers for Disease Control. And the ideology of Reagan denied these important roles. It made a further prediction that if you stripped away the regulations, if you lowered the tax rates, the economy would grow so much that everybody would be better off. Those predictions have now been tested for 40 years, and they're totally wrong. Growth slowed by about a third, and what little growth occurred went almost entirely to the top 10%, mostly to the top 1%, a lot of it to the top 0.1%. And the middle and the bottom saw their income stagnate or even decline. And that presents us to where we are today. The U.S. has a lower life expectancy than it did a few years ago, and lower health status as measured by lots of indicators. And this coronavirus, COVID-19, is not an equal opportunity killer. It goes after the people with low health status who have other problems, and it goes after those people who are in frontline jobs protecting all of us.
Right. And so there's a direct connection between all of that and massive corporate profits, massive CEO pay, and 40% of people in the U.S. living paycheck to paycheck, unable to pay an emergency $400 expense. This was before COVID-19.
Exactly. And that's why already the number of people who are behind in their rent is enormous, and almost twice as much as it was a year ago, and is only going to get worse. The data that has just come out about the plummeting in GDP, the increase in unemployment, things are just going to be getting worse. And clearly, this administration has not been able to put together, in spite of spending $2.7 trillion, put together a package that will address the needs our country faces.
Today we are speaking with Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz. He'll be with us for about 15 or so more minutes. So if you have any questions or comments for Professor Stiglitz, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Professor Stiglitz, I want to stick with solutions for low-income workers because they are being hit the hardest, and workers who have no choice but to work. I talked to a delivery guy the other day, an African-American man, and I asked him how he was doing, and he said, you know, everybody in my neighborhood is working because we don't have a choice. We have to put food on the table. And these are the people who are putting their lives at risk by working every day. So can we talk about some solutions for the lowest income workers and those who do not have a choice?
Well, the first thing is that we need to do is worry about the health both of them and the country. So we need to have paid sick leave for everybody. In a sense, the irony is that Congress recognized it, but then under the influence of these large corporations, they exempted 80% of our workforce. And if you look at the data, it is those low-income workers that do not have paid sick leave. About 30% of the lowest decile has no paid sick leave. And that means when they get sick, they go to work, even though it may spread the disease. The second thing that we need to do, absolutely, is provide them with face masks, protective gear. You know, this came up just in the last few days in the meatpacking industry, where they were being asked to go to work under conditions that exposed them, that did not comply with the distancing rules. They were not given masks. They were not being tested. Just the elementary safety health precautions. And then the president says he's going to basically force them to go to work. Well, I hope when they do that, at least they provide them with those basic ingredients. And the office of the government that is supposed to provide those protections, called OSHA, has refused to step up and mandate the provision of these health protections. It is just so unfair that we're asking these people to go to work to provide us the basic things that keep our economy going and not providing them the essentials. You know, and this is even going on in our hospitals, where they have not been able still to provide the tests and masks that are needed.
Right. And Professor Stiglitz, we should also say that those CDC guidelines for meat processing plants were just implemented 2 days ago, and they are voluntary. So this is months after the outbreak started, and we just are now getting guidelines. And we should also say that most of the workers are immigrants.
That's right. And, you know, these are people with very low bargaining power and are just surviving. And so the imbalance of market power is just stark. And this is where government needs to play an important role to protect those who can't stand up for themselves. And, you know, these meatpacking workers are providing the food that all of us live on. And so in some sense, we bear a responsibility. They're putting their lives at risk to provide us with food. The minimum that we should do is to say, everybody, the employers, they're making lots of money. The, you know, part of the minimum compensation package should be not only a minimum wage that's much higher, but sick leave and protective gear.
Yeah, because these are, we're talking about the massive meat processing plants. These are billion-dollar corporations.
Very much so. And, you know, this was a problem that, that was identified a long time ago. And it was only when it looked politically unpalatable that people might go to the store and not see meat that the administration finally took action. But as you said, it's still only voluntary. It needs to be mandatory. We shouldn't, as we go to the store, worry about whether the food that we're eating is coming at the expense of the lives of the people who are providing us with that food.
We have an email from Art. He says, what should the public be demanding of Congress to do for the economy and our workers right now?
Well, I think what is very clear is that the package, as large as it was, that $2.7 trillion, was not well designed. And in particular, it was designed under the hypothesis that the lockdown would be very short and there would be a V-shaped recovery. We now know that's not going to happen. All the forecasts are very high likelihood that this will be an extended downturn. That means we have to totally redesign the program. The worst program probably was the PPP, the program that was supposed to go to small businesses administered by the banks. The banks are getting something like $6.7 billion just to transfer electronic information that the government already ought to have in its IRS files and its Social Security files. It's just another giveaway to the banks. But in the midst of it all, the banks have given preferential treatment to their better customers. Not a surprise, they're profit-making organizations. And the result of it is that the most vulnerable small businesses have not been able to get the money they need. The first tranche of the program, $350 billion, went out the door in 13 days. The next tranche is expected to go out in a few days, even after enormous hiccups in the rollout of the program. So there is an alternative that has been put forward, which consists of giving money directly to the employers to pass on directly to the workers under, say, $85,000 per year. It would cost a fraction of this program. It would go to the workers regardless of the industry, whether it's in education or health, not just the profit-making industries. It would maintain the tie between the workers and their employers, arresting this terrible increase, 26 million already in unemployment, and putting, since Americans depend so much on employer-provided health insurance, this is going to put an enormous burden on our Medicaid and our public health programs. We began way behind with the worst in the advanced countries, and this is going to make things even worse than that.
Art also asks, what should Joe Biden be preparing to ask Congress or implement next January if he wins this November's election?
Well, I think he needs to have a comprehensive program that begins by focusing on health. I mean, we obviously have to control the pandemic, and that means test, protective gear, paid sick leave, making sure access to health care for everybody so that they get the treatment they need. So this actually fits in with the agenda that has been on the part of every Democratic candidate, which is making sure everybody has access to health care. There's a debate about how to do it, but that commitment needs to be up front. So health is first. Secondly, protecting the vulnerable. Other countries have done so much a better job than the United States of getting money out. And so even with the weakening of our administrative capacity, we need to think about the best ways of getting money out. And I gave you an example just a few minutes ago using the information that's already within the Social Security and IRS. So we need to get that money out to those who are most vulnerable. That needs the priority. The third is recognizing that the recovery is going to be difficult. Some businesses will have folded. Balance sheets of corporations and households will have been weakened. People will be nervous for good reason, uncertain. Is this going to come back? Is there going to be a second, third wave? So we are going to need more support. And part of that will be should be public investments in the areas that we need it so badly, including science, infrastructure, and health, education, and climate. Addressing, you know, the climate risk has not gone away as we focused on the pandemic risk to our health. So those are things that ought to be resuscitating the economy in a way that make sure that the inequalities that we've had get addressed, because those inequalities have played out so viciously in this pandemic.
Well, thank you for the question, Art. We have a question from Howard. Can cities and states step into the vacuum left by the federal government? Can they issue scrip for citizens to use paying rent and buying groceries?
That's a very good question. Well, first of all, the states and localities are going to be devastated. Mm-hmm. Their revenues in the 2008 crisis, their tax revenues fell almost twice the amount that the GDP fell. And if forecasts about how GDP is going to fall are correct, this is going to be an unprecedented crisis for the states. The states have balanced budget frameworks. That means that the revenues go down. They have to cut their expenditures. And in the normal course of events, that would have led to, on its own, significant increase in unemployment. Economists talk about a multiplier process. You know, in Europe, we talked about how austerity led the Greek economy to go down by 25%, youth unemployment went up to 60%. It hurt Spain. It hurt Ireland. But we're going to have, without federal assistance, austerity coming from the state and local governments. And that's why I believe it's imperative that there be that assistance. And the kind of statement that came out of Mitch McConnell that let them go bankrupt was unconscionable in my mind. It was uncompassionate. It was disastrous from the point of the economy. It reflected a lack of concern about the future of America because the stakes are at the forefront in providing health, education, and welfare. Now, the question posed had a little very interesting twist to it. Could the stakes start issuing scrip, like printing their own money? In effect, and it's happened a few times. A far better solution would be the federal government giving the assistance. But in the absence of that, it may be that the states will have to turn to scrip. California did it once about a quarter century ago. It's been done, and you know, a few other times. But it's a stopgap measure. The real thing we need is federal assistance. And that kind of assistance has been done earlier in a bipartisan way, in a time when we had more, you might say, solidarity within our country, more compassion within our country.
Well, Professor Stiglitz, thank you for your work. Thank you for joining us. I also just wanted to mention, in I believe it was your New York Review of Books piece, another solution you write about is we could reverse the tax cuts for corporations and billionaires of 2017 and move towards a fairer tax system. I mean, we talk about this on a pretty regular basis on the show.
You're absolutely right, and that would give us the revenues that we needed to address the inequalities and the other deficiencies in our basic social infrastructure.
Well, thank you. I hope you and your loved ones stay healthy. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Joseph Stiglitz is a Nobel Prize-winning economist and professor at Columbia University. You can find all of his latest pieces at yourcallradio.org. And coming up after a break, we'll speak with Thea Lee, president of the Economic Policy Institute, and we'll continue talking about unemployment benefits, financial relief, and solutions. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will talk about how COVID-19 is affecting Indian country. There are nearly 1,600 confirmed cases of the virus across the Navajo Nation and 58 reported deaths. What will it take to ensure indigenous communities get the resources they need? That is tomorrow. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can send us an email, yourcall@kalw.org. You can also find all of our past shows at yourcallradio.org. Now I would like to welcome Thea Lee to the show. Thea is president of the Economic Policy Institute, where she began her career there as an international trade economist in the 1990s. Thea Lee is co-author of The Field Guide to the Global Economy. She's authored a number of publications on NAFTA, the impact of international trade on U.S. wage inequality, and the domestic steel and textile industries. And Thea joins us from Washington, D.C. Hi, Thea. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Rose. Thank you so much for having me.
Great to have you. How are you and your loved ones doing?
We are comfortable and cozy. Thank you for asking.
Okay. I'm so glad to hear that. Thea, I just want to ask you a question. It just came up during the musical break. Talking with Professor Stiglitz, one of his main solutions, one of many, is to reverse the tax cuts for corporations and billionaires of 2017. We've had so many conversations on this show about what it would take to move toward a fairer tax system and what that would look like. Are any Democrats calling for that right now in Washington?
You know, I think a lot of people would like to see that happen because that tax bill, the 2017 tax bill, was just unconscionable and it blew a big hole in the budget without giving us anything in return. I think part of what's happening right now is that people are so focused on the immediate crisis that, you know, raising the issue about raising taxes on the wealthy or in corporations, as necessary as it is, I think is not likely to get bipartisan support at this particular moment in time, and people are trying to just get the emergency aid through. And so that question, I think, is like a medium-term and a longer-term question. It's absolutely important, but it's maybe not going to happen right at this moment.
Hmm. Well, let's talk about where we are at this moment. As you know, you have written about this. The unemployment and the financial relief, unfortunately, has not gotten to everyone who needs it. Here in California, we're the home of Facebook, Google, you name the tech company, government officials said that our system is just antiquated. And so people are having a hard time getting answers. They're having a hard time with the website. This is in California. And we're seeing this really across the country. Can you talk about this, Thea, about how difficult it has been for people to get financial relief? Again, just days before rent and bills are due this Friday.
Sure. One of the most important elements of the CARES Act, the Relief Act, was to expand the unemployment insurance system, which is really kind of a lifeblood for a lot of people. And the changes made to the unemployment system were really important. They expanded eligibility, they lengthened the time, they increased the amount of money, and that could be and should be a lifeline for a lot of working people. And yet what we've found is that we have 50 different UI systems throughout the states, and almost all of them have been underfunded, they're understaffed, and as you say, they're using antiquated, outdated technology. Their computer systems are so creaky and old that they had a lot of limited amount of options for even how what kind of program could be put in place because the computer systems couldn't handle some of the changes. So this is really just ridiculous in a wealthy country like the United States. We need to adequately fund and staff and provide technology for these systems so that they can be our rapid response in a time of crisis.
And like you said, this is directly connected to decades of budget cuts.
Yes, exactly. I was on a call with President Lee Saunders from AFSCME, the union, and he said this is the austerity chickens are coming home to roost right now, that all the kind of bad decisions made over the last couple of decades of cutting back on funding for these programs, for the administration of the programs, let alone the benefits, is coming to haunt us right now when we find that we cannot get the money out the door quickly enough to help people who are in need. And it's frustrating. I'm obviously frustrating for the people who are eligible for unemployment insurance, and yet they call and they find that there's a 4-hour or 6-hour wait on the telephone just to get through. And at the Economic Policy Institute, where I work, we did a study last week where we found that for every 10 people who filed for unemployment insurance, there were 3 or 4 people who just couldn't get through to the actually make that filing, and another 2 people who just gave up because they thought it was too difficult. So that means that the number of people who are probably eligible for unemployment is even larger than the huge numbers we've seen in the last 5 weeks.
And this results in millions of people not getting benefits. You and your colleagues at the EPI conducted a survey and estimated that between 8.9 and 13.9 million people could have filed benefits over the last 4 weeks if the process was easier.
Exactly. And that's crazy. That's a lot of people who are eligible for benefits or potentially eligible for benefits but could not even use the system that was built to help them.
Well, I will say to people in California, keep trying. I mean, I know that it's not a good message. Just keep trying. But the EDD is now open from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. And Governor Newsom said that they're adding staffers. So the best we can tell you right now is just to keep trying. And today we are speaking with Thea Lee, president of the Economic Policy Institute, where she began her career as an international trade economist. And if you have any questions or comments for Thea, if you'd like to share a story about trying to get financial relief, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Thea, you recently wrote a piece in Time magazine with 2 colleagues, Liz Watson and Felicia Wong, and you write, "Our policy choices now can and should prevent the permanent economic scarring and lifelong health consequences of unemployment, which could affect 3 in 10 Americans over the course of the crisis. We need a clear federal response, a paycheck guarantee." Can you tell us more about that?
Sure. So this is a piece I did with, as you say, Liz Watson from the Congressional Progressive Caucus Center and Felicia Wong from the Roosevelt Institute. And what we were doing was trying to step back and say, what could we have done? What should we be doing? And we were looking at what some other countries, particularly in Europe, the United Kingdom and Denmark and a few others have done as well, which was just a paycheck guarantee. It's very simple, just to say the government will actually pick up 80% or up to 100% of the payrolls for people, even if the work has dried up. And this is this would be simple. You know, we have almost like a patchwork system now where we have the unemployment insurance, we have the checks for households, we have aid for small businesses, we have aid for big businesses, and we have aid to state and local governments. But that would, what we thought is one way of like deep freezing the economy, that if you can keep people connected to their employer, connected to their benefits, their health care in particular, then the trauma, the economic trauma of this downturn would be much smaller, both for people and for businesses, so that people could keep getting most of their paycheck throughout the crisis. And when the crisis is over, when the public health crisis has ended, then there's a much smoother reentry for people to just go back, that you don't have to go, like businesses wouldn't have to, interview people, seek out people, find somebody, train somebody, and so on. You would keep people connected to their employer throughout the crisis and connected to their benefits. And we thought that would be the cleanest, the smoothest, and the most efficient way of dealing with this.
You write that a direct paycheck guarantee has become a standard policy response among many nations, including the Netherlands, Australia, Germany, Ireland, and the UK. All are focused on speed, simplicity, and certainty, and their programs seem to be working. The UK's unemployment rate, for example, is half that of the United States, in part because government policy has given businesses enough certainty to maintain their workforces. Thea, the argument that we often hear when it comes to these kinds of programs is that the United States is just so much bigger than these European countries. What is your response to that?
Well, that's not a good answer because we're bigger, but that means we have more resources also, as well as more people. We're a wealthy country. We can and we must afford to be able to take care of people. This is a government-created economic shutdown. The government has told businesses to close. It has told people to stay home. People are doing what they have been asked to do, and it is the government's responsibility to prevent economic trauma from happening. And, you know, the federal government can and should step in at this moment. They can borrow the money. They can print the money. And it is actually cheaper than trying to clean up the mess 6 months from now when companies have gone bankrupt and workers and people have lost their houses, they've been evicted, they've lost their health care and so on. It's actually economically smarter and more efficient for the federal government to step in right now and spend the money and keep people connected to their employers than it is to try to fix all the damage that's done after the fact.
You write that there is the Paycheck Guarantee Act, which was introduced by Representative Pramila Jayapal, that would provide 3 months of direct payroll support to businesses that can demonstrate a COVID-related shutdown or revenue loss. And then on the other side, Senator Josh Hawley has expressed support for a paycheck guarantee. Why, Thea, has it taken so long, given that, you know, this is, again, the second month that people are going to have to pay their bills under COVID-19, in some cases really the third month?
Yeah, we've seen the usual kind of battle happening in Washington, D.C., and certainly I would have to say Senator McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, has been very obstructionist in terms of allowing the kind of adequate, speedy, timely, efficient funding to go out that would prevent some of the economic damage from happening. I mean, I think there are sort of there are legitimate concerns. I mean, we don't all agree on what's the best way of addressing this crisis. And I think the crisis has been rolling out, you know, even for EPI, we look and say, oh, it looks like it's going to be 4 million jobs. No, it's 14 million. Now it's 20 million. You know, the number of jobs has kept growing. I think people didn't correctly anticipate the magnitude of the crisis. One of the things that we have said is what Congress needs to do is not try to guess how long the crisis is going to last or how deep it's going to be, but to build into the policy solutions an automatic trigger so that the, you know, whether it's cash to households or expanded unemployment insurance or aid to state and local governments, Congress should say now we will commit to an adequate amount of support in each of these areas for as long as it takes. And then they don't have to come back every couple of weeks and throw a few more dollars into the pot, because that's not working very well. And it's causing so much uncertainty and distress for both businesses and workers. It's almost the worst possible way of doing it, and in the end it's going to cost a lot of money anyway. So we may as well just do it right and commit to an adequate amount of support now.
We have an email from Neil who says, I was able to process a claim for unemployment benefits under the PUA by going online at 5 a.m. He says, I'd suggest that applicants try going online during less busy times as the system overloads and crashes frequently under the weight of daily traffic. Well, Neil, I'm glad you got in at 5 a.m. Well, thank you for the email. Jennifer writes, I'm a self-employed solo practitioner. I am my only employee. I have yet to get benefits to help me with my $10,000 loss. I do not qualify for any grants thus far. All other grants require a minimum of 2 employees. Speaking of taxes, Trump's tax reform increased our taxes by 100%. That's not a typo, Jennifer writes, 100%. I couldn't get the EDD website working yesterday. I've only received $1,000 in mid-April from the EIDL that I filled out in March. I'm $9K in a growing hole. Help. So many people are facing these crises.
They really are, and it's heartbreaking to hear the individual stories. The expansion of the unemployment insurance should help somebody like Jennifer too, because for the first time, when we expanded eligibility, self-employed workers and gig workers are eligible for unemployment insurance, and that can be, it adds a $600 per week to the normal amount. So that is a significant help for a lot of people.
Right, and we should say that here in California, at least, starting yesterday, if you are self-employed, if you're an independent contractor or a gig worker, you can now apply for benefits, and you might want to take Neil's advice and go on the website at very off hours because the system is completely overloaded. Jennifer, thank you for writing in. We're really thinking about you and other small business owners, sole proprietors, and we're going to continue doing shows to try to get you some kind of help. But be sure to check out the EDD's website because you now qualify for benefits. Thank you again for sending us an email. Let's hear from a caller. Let's go to Leonard in San Francisco. Hi, Leonard, welcome to the show. Hi, Leonard.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, hi, go ahead.
Hi. Okay, I'm facing a loophole in the new pandemic unemployment for freelancers that's going to affect probably thousands of people in my business. I work as a freelance film and video worker. Most of us, even though my income is 97%, 1099s, I have a small amount of W-2 income. And you can't get PUA, which is the new freelancer one, if you qualify for regular unemployment. Now, my award, if I was getting the freelancer unemployment, would be a minimum of around 170 or something a week, and maybe as much as 450. But I'm forced to qualify instead under my regular unemployment, which was based on $2,300 from 2 days of work this year. So I'm getting an award of $40 a week with regular unemployment, whereas I would get much more if I was able to qualify under my main income. Moreover, because I didn't apply for it, for unemployment, because I was waiting for the new unemployment to come out, I missed a month of unemployment that would have been, the $600 last month. So there's a tremendous loss that's going to happen to my potential income. And many, many, many of us are already complaining about this problem.
So you're getting just $40 a week right now?
My unemployment award is $40 a week. Yet I made $90,000 last year. If I was getting pandemic unemployment, I'd get a minimum of 170 and maybe as much as 450.
Leonard, have you been able to reach anyone at the EDD?
I have an appointment. There's a sneaky way to get, I managed to get myself an appointment next week with EDD, but I don't think they can do anything about this. Because this is the way the law seems to be written in the federal statute, but because you're only available for pandemic unemployment if you don't get regular UI. But every state seems to determine that differently. Like I went onto the website for Colorado, and based on the amount of work that I had, I would not be available. I would not be qualified for regular unemployment in Colorado. But in California, I do.
Well, Leonard, I'm going to write this down, and we'll try to ask some politicians about this. We're actually trying to get in touch with the EDD to join the show to answer questions like this, so we'll stay on it. Thea, do you have any comments for Leonard and others like him?
No, I wish I did, Leonard. That sounds really frustrating. And I think this is one of the issues, again, with the understaffing of the unemployment insurance. Even if Leonard had been able to talk to somebody and get some good advice early on, at least he would have gotten that $600 a week on top of the $40 for the last month. So now he's lost out on that, it sounds like. I'm not an expert on the systems, but this does seem like something that certainly there should be qualified people who can walk folks through it and help them understand what are the advantages and disadvantages and the timing and so on. So this must be very frustrating.
Yeah, very frustrating, Leonard. Thank you for calling, and please email us with any updates, and we will, again, write this down, and hopefully we'll do a show on it in the coming weeks, because I know so many people are in the same situation. Thank you, and good luck trying to get answers to that. I wanted to ask you, Thea, the San Francisco Chronicle reports that within the next couple of weeks, California's unemployment insurance fund will run out of money. California is now going to borrow from the federal government to keep benefits flowing. According to the Chronicle, California is vying with New York and Ohio to be the first state to go negative since the last recession. What are your thoughts on this? I mean, is it possible that money will run out? How does that work?
Well, this is certainly another area where the federal government needs to fill any gaps that are there in terms of spending, because the states generally cannot do deficit spending. They're prevented from doing that, but the federal government can. And so to the extent that there's a shortfall in funding, this is something that can and should be made up by the federal government. We see state and local governments are kind of stuck at that place where their revenues have disappeared all of a sudden because of the downturn in economic activity, and their expenses have increased. And the expenses are for things that everybody needs, and whether it's health care or public safety or other crucial things. So I think this is just an important area. We've said at EPI that we need at least another $500 billion from the federal governments to state and local governments to help cover any kinds of shortfalls, whether it's in the unemployment system or other essential spending.
We talked about repealing the Trump tax cuts earlier. We have a related question from Art, who says, what about a wealth tax at the city or state level? What are your thoughts on that, Thea, especially in a state like California where the Democrats have a supermajority?
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. If you have the political wherewithal to do it, both states and localities do need to raise more money from wealthy people, whether it's through a wealth tax or a higher income tax. And we all are going to need to both replace some of the revenues that were lost during the crisis, but also be better prepared for the next crisis. And I think what we've seen here is that, these crises are going to target the most vulnerable people, and we have not really asked enough from the most fortunate people in terms of helping to fund the kind of systems that we need to put in place. So I think a wealth tax, this is the right time to have that conversation.
And Thea, final thoughts on the lowest income workers, the workers who have no choice but to be on the front lines. NPR spoke to a McDonald's worker in L.A., Bartolome Perez. He said, you know that every time you go out, it could be your last or it could be the most expensive hamburger you make in your life. Adding to that, undocumented workers. I mean, so many undocumented workers. You know, they're in many, many cities across the country. We've done shows on farm workers, but they're in restaurants. And actually, right now, there are undocumented workers rallying to pressure the city of San Francisco to set aside more benefits for them.
Yes, I mean, I think the crisis has really exacerbated and brought into relief all the inequalities that existed before. They've become so much worse. And the difference between people who can continue to work comfortably at their computers and their telephones, whose income is not interrupted versus people who either lose their job and have no income or are forced to continue going to work at a low-paid job without proper protection and voice on the job and protective equipment and so on. So I hope that going forward that we will take from this, take to heart the idea that we need better jobs and better workplaces and better protections for working people all the time, not just during a pandemic, but during a pandemic it is now a life and death kind of issue as opposed to just a fairness issue.
Well, Thea, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Rose. It was lovely to talk to you, even under these trying circumstances.
Yes, likewise, and I hope you and your family stay healthy and safe. Thank you.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thea Lee is president of the Economic Policy Institute. You can find the piece that she wrote in Time magazine about a direct paycheck guarantee at yourcallradio.org. I also wanted to let you know that if you are in California, we found a couple of new resources. And if you're in the Bay Area, this is a really important one. If you work for a company or a nonprofit that is part of the Healthy SF program, you have access to $1,300. There's $138 million in the medical reimbursement account. San Francisco Mayor London Breed is going to free that up to workers, so over 100,000 employees will have access to $1,300. So again, if you're part of a company or a nonprofit that takes part in Healthy SF, you have access to $1,300. Also, if you run a small business in San Francisco's Bayview District, there is now a $500,000 grant program that's going to be run by Economic Development on 3rd. And you can find all of this information along with some other resources at kalw.org. Just click on the resource box on the right-hand side, and we will continue doing these shows to try to find out where is relief for individuals and small business owners. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance and Damian Miner for keeping the studio up and running. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.